A podcast of the cinema.
Good evening to you.
Yes.
Alonzo Duralde.
Thank you, Dave White.
You're the rap reviews editor.
Yes.
You are the film reviews editor at the Wrap. You mm-hmm. are the co-host of Who Shot Ya podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. You are a person who used to do a YouTube show called What the Flick. Now you do a podcast that is apparently using that name right now as y'all transition into something else.
Correct. And you...
What do I do?
You write reviews for the Wrap, including Maria by Callas, which you just reviewed. That it's currently up right now.
It is currently up right now.
And...
I'm somebody, you know.
And you do all the heavy lifting of our Patreon page.
That's a thing that... We'll just talk to you about it right now and get out of the way, because we're not going to do letters today.
Yes. Too many movies to cover.
And we're not going to say it again after we say it once.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. It's where you can find all the extra goodies that you would want of a show that you might like.
So many. Things, extra content, extra podcasts.
Yes.
Other things.
LKTV, a podcast of the cinema. Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics. Linoleum Nights, where we say swears and record the show on Facebook Live and talk about trickier subjects and all sorts of great prizes.
Right. Everything that I just said, you just repeated what I just said.
I'm giving detail. Fine. Know you like a detail.
I do. I just don't like to hammer this onto people.
Well, this could be somebody's first episode.
It might be. Welcome to you.
Hi.
Also, you go to patreon.com/linoleumknife.
And it's all there.
If this is your first episode, what else should you know about us?
We're film critics and we're married to each other.
Boom. We got a lot. So many. Listen.
Did you put Maria by Callas on that gigantic list that you read me earlier?
Guess what I forgot to put on that list earlier? I was so absorbed by that film and that writing that review that when I was finished with it, I was like, well, there we go. I'm done. And then I forgot that we're going
to
also
talk. You don't get to review a movie once. That never happens.
We're not going to do letters this week. Are we even going to do DVD recommendations? Let's not.
It'll take 2 seconds.
We have like 8 or 9 movies to talk about this week. But here's the thing. We have like 8 or 9 movies to talk about for the foreseeable future of episodes.
It's award season.
It is November, and then it will be December, and that is when film critics become like the elves in Santa's workshop. We do not sleep. We only watch movies and talk about them and write about them.
I think we're more like Lucy Ricardo at the chocolate conveyor belt. They just keep pumping them out, and we just have to start cramming them into our mouths.
That's me. Competent people.
And into our hats.
Are doing other things. But it becomes a crazy onslaught.
Yeah.
So here we go.
Woo!
Let's rev it up.
Let's.
It's actually nighttime.
It is.
I like to do these podcasts in the morning or the afternoon when I'm feeling fresh. Because right now, it is 8:15 p.m.
Bed is calling you.
I should, by rights, have already, gotten to my nice pajamas.
And your nightcap.
And my nightcap. I should have already eaten one segment of weed chocolate. Because, y'all, I have the worst insomnia. And it's one of the few things that helps.
And it's California, and it's legal here.
It's completely legal here, yeah. And I hate smoking, so I just want that piece of chocolate to help me not be awake at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yes.
Yeah. It kind of works. most of the time. It won't stop me from having like a full-blown 2 a.m. panic attack.
Well.
Because if that's going to happen, that's going to happen. But in general, it gives me nice sleep.
Good.
Yeah. That's where I should be right now. But what happened was that today got all crazy. It was a Monday, and there were so many things to do, mm-hmm. and including going to see The Grinch.
Which we are under embargo about, but we'll talk about on next week's show.
Are we allowed to say anything about it?
We are under embargo.
We can't say, even if we liked it?
We are under embargo.
All right. Okay.
We cannot say that we perhaps enjoyed it, because that would be a violation of the embargo.
All right. We will not say that we perhaps enjoyed it.
Yes.
We will not violate the embargo.
No.
Anyway. Hey, Maria by Callas.
Yes, why not? Let's kick off with that.
It's a documentary. It's about Maria Callas. Hey, Brainless, do you know who Maria Callas is? No. That's from It's Wonderful Life. Anyway, Maria Callas was an American-born soprano opera singer in the 20th century. By many estimates, she was the greatest opera singer of the 20th century. If you are super into opera and you disagree with that, I understand. Because there were a lot of people who did disagree with that. I am not one of them.
Who do those people pick?
Who knows? I don't know who they pick. But she had... I'm speaking as an opera fan here.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of opera. I go to the opera. I get myself those cheap balcony seats at the Los Angeles Opera that cost as much as it costs to see a movie at the Arclight. $18 to $20.
And you get those Maria Callas CDs and play them in the car.
Yes, I have opera compact discs. Our 18-year-old car has a compact disc player Woo-hoo. In it. And I have many opera recordings on compact disc. They're very inexpensive because nobody wants them anymore.
Physical media. Yeah. Who needs that?
And I mean, I'm seriously, you could go to Amoeba and buy entire, like, archival recording, like, good ones, mm-hmm. $3-4.
But used, but
Used, yeah, but, I mean, in perfect playing condition. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, and she's my go-to. And as far as ladies go, she's my go-to. Because she had a dramatic, expressive voice. There's an Italian expression for her voice that literally translates to big, big, ugly thing. Which, I can't remember what the expression is, but it's like a great thing that...
Like gran boccaccia
or something. Yeah, something like that, yeah. Big mouth, you know, kind of voice. I did not know this, really, that there was this controversy about her voice until somewhat recently. Hmm. You know, I'm the kind of opera fan who just thinks it's great to just get to go to the opera. So I don't... I in the past 5 to 10 years, I've become the kind of person who is starting to know when I like something and when I don't.
Nah.
We have a very famous male opera singer here in Los Angeles, a world famous
yes.
male opera singer here in Los Angeles, who is now the
director
of the LA Opera,
Plácido Domingo.
And he, you're gonna name names because I was about to put him on blast.
He's the director of the LA Opera.
Yeah, well, make people Google it a little bit.
That wouldn't take very long.
Make him work.
All right,
make him work.
Put Mr. Lazy Sunday on blast. What's the deal?
His voice once
mm-hmm. at was, its apex
was great. Now he's like 70 and he can still knock it out.
Yeah.
I'm not saying he can't. I'm just saying there are moments when you can feel him lifting. You can feel him doing the lifting. Well, and I've now seen him perform in 3 different operas. Uh-huh. And it's gotten to the point where if I see his name, on the opera as a lead, mm-hmm. I think, you know what, maybe I'll skip that one. Now, what kind of where are you in life as an opera lover if you're like, if you're thinking, yeah, Plácido Domingo, seen him a few times.
Well, but, I'm over it. He is one of the few names in opera, but yeah, he is not, it's not like 1982 Plácido Domingo.
No. Then I would be, I would feel great.
Of course. And I would feel grateful.
And then,
really,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know much about the history of opera, and so maybe I'm about to say something that's totally untrue, but before Plácido Domingo and Luciano Pavarotti, like...
I really like it how you say his name all Spanish, because he's Spanish, and you're Spanish.
Yeah. Opera stars, like stars...
Yeah, yeah. They're few and far between.
Tended to be women, though, right?
No. There were male and female. Here's the thing. Maria Callas came along at a time when an opera star was a star, you know? Right now in the world, we have Plácido Domingo and we have Renee Fleming.
Right. I mean,
more or less.
Carita Kanawa?
I don't know how often she performs anymore. Yeah. Is she still alive? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, yeah, she's also somebody who's sort of past her peak.
I know that my opera friends who are listening to this are like, Dave White.
Pounding their heads.
They're pounding their heads now because I asked them Carita Kanawa was still alive.
Because when I remember being a kid and like going to see the Met, you know, when they would come to Atlanta with my parents.
Right.
And then, even in music class in school, we had a segment where we would learn about opera and
stuff.
If
this is a first time listener, they've already turned it off.
Oh God, yeah. They're like, what are these queens talking about? But I remember at that, like, in the 70s, before, like, the Pavarotti thing happened.
Right.
It was, like, Beverly Sills.
Yes.
And Joan Sutherland.
And Leontine Price.
Yeah. And nobody talked about the men. And I know, yes, you had Alfredo Kraus, and there were great male opera singers. But in terms of being, like, household names, it was the women.
Here's why. You want to hear that diva?
Diva?
Sing that aria.
Yes.
You want to hear her. Get crazy. If you're lucky, you want to see her do a mad scene. Callas was good at the mad scenes. So anyway, here's a documentary about Maria Callas. Now that we've digressed all this way. It's by Tom Wolfe. His first documentary. The film is made up entirely of recordings and documents in her own words. So you have television interviews, private letters that have never been read out loud until now. Joyce DiDonato is the person reading these letters out loud. Personal writings, sort of, you know, personal memoir sort of style writings.
So it's Love, Gilda, but opera.
And uninterrupted performance.
Nice.
So entire selections from Tosca, Carmen, La Traviata, Norma, Casta Diva from Norma is, you know, like the, that's the one for her. And it is obviously for fans, but I think if you don't know anything about opera, but maybe you would like to see, you know, the most legendary woman singing, why don't you watch this movie? Because it's kind of like a little...
Is it a primer? I mean,
a little bit. I mean, it's she talks about her childhood. Mm-hmm. It was unhappy. Her mother pushed her very hard. Got her to lie about her age at age 13 to get into a conservatory in Greece. You're supposed to be 17. Constantly mocked her for her weight, you know. And that was always this weird thing with her because the stereotype of the fat lady opera singer is kind of a thing. Because the support that a voice like that needs was often believed to be, you know, helped by having a little butter on you, you know.
You need to resonate around you.
Yeah, yeah. And so so she dealt with that. It also goes into the controversies of her life, the fights that she had with Rudolph Bing from the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And eventually she got fired. She had creative differences with him. He, you know, he's like, you will sing La Traviata every day for the rest of your life. And she's like, you know what? Can we do something else? Like, and the answer was no. And, you know, she was not the type to mince words about people.
Right. Her affairs with...
An infamous 1958 performance where she had bronchitis and had to leave. A production of Norma after the first act. Mm. And the president of Italy was in the audience, you know.
Now, the thing I know her for is, you know, sleeping with Aristotle Onassis.
Oh, they didn't just sleep together. They were lovers. They were lovers.
They were lovers.
She left her husband for him. Then he left her for Jackie Kennedy. And then he stepped out on Jackie Kennedy with Maria Callas during the marriage. They could not quit each other.
I see.
So this film is very lovingly compiled. You know, it is a curatorial situation where
they're not to rip the lid off of.
No, there's nothing you don't know if you already know things about her. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know about her life, you'll learn the bare bones, and you'll get to hear her sing, which is. I'm not Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. I go to the opera and cry. Like, I don't do that. But when I hear her sing, I feel that, like, in my body. Like, it's when you get the
tingles.
The tingles all over your arms when you hear someone who's doing something with their voice that sounds almost supernatural.
And, you know, getting to see it in a movie theater to go somewhere that has a really kick-ass sound system, I'm sure, is really...
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I highly recommend this. I had a wonderful time. I told my friend Loretta, who's an opera friend of mine, I would go again. It's worth it just to hear the performances.
Okay.
Yeah.
What else?
Another documentary. Daughters of the Sexual Revolution.
Yes.
About the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. I actually saw this movie earlier this year in Dallas at the USA Film Festival. A lot of the interviewees of the film were in the audience, so that was pretty terrific. It is a look at the media phenomenon of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. Now, those of you who were not around for the late 70s and early 80s or don't remember it vividly.
It was a time.
Yeah.
We're old. We were kids then.
It was a moment of cultural upheaval, and the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders were hugely popular.
Yeah.
They were on posters. They were on the Love Boat. Yep. They were like a very big deal.
They were in TV commercials. They were everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, neither of us even lived in Dallas yet. And we, you know, they were inescapable. It was just a huge, huge thing. And so, you know, the movie really kind of looks at, like, how this was kind of an unprecedented thing in professional football and how it was coming around at this moment where, like, you know, feminism was becoming part of the national conversation.
In full swing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and Dallas as a city was becoming a really big deal because, like, you know, they were, you know, the oil money was happening and it was like they were really kind of establishing themselves as a major presence. And so, you know, the movie mainly focuses on a woman named Suzanne Mitchell, who was somebody who worked in the Cowboys front office and basically became the woman who tended to the cheerleaders. And she ran them with an iron fist and she had all these rules they had to follow. And, you know, the women...
But apparently they did a lot of rule breaking.
Well, of course they did. But, you know, the rules were there nonetheless. And, you know, the women who were actually being on the squad, like, it was super competitive to get on.
Right.
They were working their asses off because they were getting paid like nothing. And
oh, really?
Oh, yeah. They got paid like $10 a game or something crazy like that.
Is that in the film? Because I don't remember hearing that.
Yeah, they mentioned it in the film. All right. And, you know, and so nobody was doing this like as their main job. They all had jobs during the day, and then at night they would go and rehearse.
Right.
You know, and they had, you couldn't miss rehearsal. that was part of the rules. You know,
they,
like
they pay him now, though. Right?
They I'm sure now. Yeah, it's much different. But now, okay. But back then it was like it was an honor, you know, sort of thing. And so it's, you know, the movie is charming, and it's there's a lot of really fun period footage, and it really kind of captures that sort of bizarre moment of the culture.
That is what makes it worth watching.
Yeah,
all the period archival footage that they have is delightful,
and a lot of the women have really interesting stories to tell, and they come off as really charming. And you do get this sense of the sisterhood of all the people who were there and how they were looking out for each other, and you know how it sort of fell apart once like Jerry Jones comes in and that kind of stuff. And I mean, you know, the movie again, like you were saying, it is a lovingly curated documentary. They are not out to like you know make anybody look bad, you know, at least not anybody in the sort of tech SRAM era look bad. So it is there are probably a lot of questions that go unasked.
I had many of those questions. I wouldn't call myself torn on the subject of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, because I find them more a cartoon sort of caricature version of sexiness.
Yeah, they're like Hooters girls.
Than I do as anything it's that like, would be remotely considered sexual.
Yeah, it was short shorts hose.
Yeah,
there is a whole section of the film, sorry, talking about Debbie Does Dallas, which is fun.
I'm glad you brought up Debbie Does Dallas, because it caused me to have many questions that the film is sort of too invested in being adorable to answer. There is an interrogation of what they meant to feminism that the film doesn't really pick up and run with. It's a very authorized look, and it wants you to understand them the way they understand themselves,
right?
As we're cute and we're wholesome and we're sexy and here's our cleavage.
Yes.
There was this funny porn movie made about us, but it wasn't really about us.
They tried to sue that movie. Yes. Like they tried to make it go away and they couldn't, you know. But I think the movie's idea of feminism is these women had the agency to choose to do this.
Correct.
And, you know, they had this other woman who was making sure that they were like being taken care of, maybe not financially, but like at least, you know, not being exploited in a way that other people might have and did later.
But there are questions about what that means to culture that the film is not interested in talking about. There is cultural criticism to be had around the subject of, you know, this group of people.
Sure.
And Susan Brown Miller, who wrote Against Our Will, is in the film.
Right.
But how many times does she get to speak? You know, not too many. And
I don't think that's the movie they wanted to make.
That is not the movie they wanted to make. But there is this subject hovering over this film that should be discussed.
Yes, but I think they could have easily avoided it entirely. I think including her in the film shows they're at least like acknowledging that yes, there is this conversation to be had, but we're not interested in having it. We're interested in telling this story and kind of saluting this woman, you know.
And saluting the
Suzanne Miller,
the cheerleaders.
Yeah.
They should be saluted.
They should.
I think they were really cool. At the same time, I wanted this documentary to do more, to ask tougher questions, and to be willing to put that element of friction into it, even if there is no clear-cut response.
Sure. I mean, because the title promises that level of conversation.
It does, and it doesn't deliver. Yeah. And I understand that there is not a clear-cut response. I'm not saying I know what this movie should have been about. All I wanted is this movie to say the words that it should have said about what does this mean?
You wanted them to join the conversation.
Yes, with Pepsi. Because again, no, there's no easy answer to this. Are you exploiting yourself?
Yeah.
Is your agency leading to your own exploitation?
Right.
I don't know. I don't have an answer because it might be a little of both. It might be a little of both good and bad.
Sure.
And that's the friction in life that you live with on many subjects, not merely the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. And so, yeah, I wanted this movie to be more
fair
than cheerleading.
But if you're there for the kitsch value, yeah, it is there in spades.
Anyway, Nobody's Fool.
Yes. Okay.
It's the new film from Tyler Perry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we have to talk about it all that much.
Well, people...
It's not
people,
especially exciting.
People
discuss.
Love it when we talk about Tyler Perry, because we do see his movies.
No, in the history of this podcast, what people like is when we go in on a Tyler Perry movie.
True.
And some of them deserve that, and some of them do not.
And some of them are actually, you know, we
some
will...
Some of them are actually good.
Yeah, some of them we will praise and acknowledge when they deserve it. Yeah, this is just one of the eh ones.
This is a quintessential eh.
Yeah, one. Despite the presence of Tiffany Haddish, who you would think would somehow elevate the material, but really it's... She's the only thing this movie has.
It's not outlandishly scolding of its characters. I mean, there's a little of all that in every one of his films, but...
There's no Jesus.
There's no Jesus. It's rated R.
Yeah.
There's everyone is using the bad words, and there are sex scenes.
Yes.
In this movie. Explicit sex scenes.
Well, I mean, not film. Like... Let's be clear about it. There are rated sex scenes. But like you
first of all, how many movies in recent memory have sex scenes, even R-rated ones? Think about that.
I suppose.
How many of those? It's not the 70s anymore.
Okay, but this movie is mainly rated R for language because it's not like... Okay, you don't see... There are no breasts. There are no, like, buttocks. Like, so yes, there are...
Are you insane? Were you not looking? Did you not notice the buttocks?
Okay, there were some buttocks, but there were no breasts. When you say... Here's the thing. When you say the words explicit sex scenes, I'm thinking explicit sex
scenes. A screen full of two people humping.
Yes.
Yes.
There is sex happening. It is being portrayed in a film.
Yes.
But not in a, like... You know, it's fairly modest as
okay,
still as...
We don't have to keep talking about this one particular element of the film.
I just wanted to be clear.
Let's... Okay.
Anyway.
Talk about what it's about.
Okay. So, Tika Sumpter is a career woman, and so you know that means she's going to be punished by Tyler Perry.
She's very uptight.
Super uptight. And pushing down all of her emotions.
And wickedly rich for someone in a...
She is sort of
middle management position.
She is hoping to get a promotion to be a VP at an ad agency, and she lives in the giantest New York City high-rise apartment that, like, some oil sheik should be buying and never using or parking his motorcycles in. Like, this place is enormous.
Right.
Of course, it's directed, it's decorated, like, in a completely tacky and soulless way. But, you know, her square footage is astonishing.
It's lady luxury. I wouldn't call it especially tacky.
Okay,
it's just not what you want.
It's not tacky, but it's not, it doesn't have anybody's stamp of personality. It's a model home, you know. Anyway, so she is a, you know, like rising young business exec. Her sister, Tiffany Haddish, is just getting out of jail after 5 years, is in recovery, and...
But just barely all of these things.
Yes. And their mother, who's played by Whoopi Goldberg, does not want Tiffany Haddish to stay with her in Jersey, so she's got to stay with Tika Sumpter. Tika Sumpter has a long-distance boyfriend who she has never seen for varying reasons that sound more and more complicated. And Tiffany Haddish comes to the logical conclusion that she's being catfished. There's a guy who runs the coffee shop next to the office of Tika Sumpter who is clearly in love with her, played by Omari Hardwick. He gives Tiffany Haddish a job. What even happens in this movie? I don't know.
A lot of things.
Nev and Max from Catfish show up and determine that she is
as themselves,
determine that she is being catfished. So then she starts dating Omari Hardwick, but then except that she doesn't want to because he turns out to have she has a list of things that she wants in a man.
It's exhausting. This film is exhausting.
Yeah, it is. You think it's over, and then it's like there's a whole other act.
There is... There is nothing comedic happening until Tiffany Haddish walks into a room.
Yeah.
And then...
And she's making it all
and
up.
And she's improving. She's improving everything.
So many scenes end with other characters breaking and laughing.
Yeah. The usual amounts of dead air in a Tyler Perry comedy drama are all still here.
Oh, yeah.
Because he doesn't... And
the
does
pacing
not,
is slack.
He doesn't know and or doesn't care after all these years how to make a film.
This is his 20th.
Do what you want a film to do.
It's a theatrical feature. He's still phoning it.
So it relies entirely on the goodwill and manic energy of Tiffany Haddish.
Yeah.
As you said in your review, she is the Madea.
Basically.
Of this movie. And it needed a Madea.
Yeah.
And so we got one. A young, cool Madea.
Yeah.
That's it. It is not good.
No.
I laughed when Tiffany Haddish was on screen. So I did laugh fairly often. And there's a nice sort of button at the end with Tiffany Haddish reviving a joke that she has already made in public
right
a couple times. And I love that her commitment to keeping this joke going. I won't tell you what it is, just in case you decide to watch it. But if you're going to watch it, don't go to a movie theater and pay all that money. Just wait until you can see it on your television, uninterrupted, you know, unedited, in its full R rating.
Yes, yes, yes.
But, whoa, what a slog. It's like 2 full hours.
Oh, yeah, and you feel them.
The only true entertainment at our screening.
I was wondering if you were going to talk about that guy.
We went on the Thursday night preview because Tyler Perry does not show his films to film critics.
No.
And this guy who was 2 rows in front of us delivered a nonstop monologue / commentary loudly.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody could hear him. And he was talking to characters, talking back to the screen.
Repeating things they had just said.
Repeating things they had just said. Describing his own opinions about what the people were doing. And he was with 3 other friends, none of whom bothered to do anything about him.
Yeah.
And who... who seemed to be perhaps chagrined a little bit, but not enough where they said, hey, shut up. I was enjoying it because...
It was a distraction.
Because it was a distraction from this boring movie. And then it got great because about 2/3 of the way through the movie, a woman down front decided that she had finally had enough after like 90 full minutes.
Of this guy going off. What the tipping point was there.
She yelled, shut the F up. And he yelled back, F you. And then in comes the security person.
Yes.
Who walks right up to you and me. And says, I don't know who's making noise around here, but it has to stop. And I go, it ain't us. And I'm pointing at the guy.
Yeah, I'm
go,
pointing to Rosa.
I'm like, it's not us. That one right there. That dude. But she kept looking at us and yelling at us. And I was like, this night just got amazing. We're about to be kicked out of the Grove Theater.
For heckling a Tyler Perry movie.
For heckling a Tyler Perry movie. And we weren't doing it. I wish I... And then after she scolded us, 5 minutes later, the guy got up and walked out.
Yeah.
Like he'd done... He had... His work was finished.
Exactly.
And...
like, you're not kicking me out. I'm leaving under my own accord.
I wish I'd gotten his business card. Because I wish he could be a guest today. On this podcast. I should have chased him out. Hey, do you want to be on a podcast? Because I think you're terrific. You've ruined this film for almost everyone in the theater except me.
Tyler Perry ruined it for me.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, he says he's killing Medea, which I'm really not happy about.
I will only be happy about that if Medea's funeral movie, mm-hmm. which is, I think, what it's called, Medea's Big Family
Medea Family Funeral or something like that.
It's coming out next year. Mm-hmm. I will only be happy about that if Medea dies at the very beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's her funeral.
It's her funeral, and then spends the rest of the movie in the coffin talking and yelling and insulting people from the coffin.
Mm.
Like, sits up like Michael Myers in Halloween to yell at people and what hit them. Yeah.
What if it's Ghost Medea?
That's second best.
Okay.
Ghost Medea would be second best to Medea undead in the coffin yelling at people.
Fair enough.
I do want her to die in a really wonderfully funny way.
Mm.
I will miss her.
I will.
I would be happy for Medea to go on as a franchise in ways that I wish Star Wars would not.
And here's the thing. If Tyler Perry were saying, I'm killing Medea and I'm not making any more movies.
Well, that's never going to happen.
Then fine. Like, then you can both go. But you're getting rid of your best character and you're so maybe endure like two of these a year.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Yeah. You know the drill with this director. He's a terrible filmmaker who makes sometimes effectively
periodically entertaining
effectively entertaining films, and sometimes not.
I mean, this is a not.
This is a not until Tiffany Haddish pops up.
But even the bits of her you get, even though she's in it throughout, it's not like she just pops up every so often.
Yeah.
But she can't elevate this thing to watchability, and I'm starting to worry about, you know, like, there's this trajectory where, like, you make a big star-making turn, and then they just put you in a bunch of movies, and then, you know, sometimes you wear out your welcome. And that hasn't happened with her yet, but it's like, after sitting through Night School and, you know...
The Oath.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different thing. That's not like it's a vehicle around her. It's like,
no, it's not.
She's a thing she was in. But you know, it's like, oh, don't make me sick of Tiffany Haddish already. I love her too much.
I won't become sick of her. I will only become sick of bad films.
Right.
And then there was the Nutcracker.
Ooh.
And the something something of the Four Musketeers. What?
The Nutcracker and the Four Realms.
The Nutcracker and the Four Realms. All right. So there's this kid, and her name is Clara, and it's Christmas Eve, and she's got to go to the party at Drosselmeyer's house.
Yes.
But then her father, who is grieving the loss of his wife, he hands her this golden egg, and he says, hey, this is your present for your mom, whatever. And she goes, well, what am I supposed to do with it? Because there's no key. And he's like, yeah, I don't know where the key is. Find it. And he goes off to mope. And then she winds up in one of the other realms, and she meets the Sugar Plum Fairy, and that's Keira Knightley. And Keira Knightley, the Sugar Plum Fairy, says, oh, please come help us, because the evil bad lady,
Mother Ginger,
Helen Mirren, wants to destroy us all. You have to go to her and get the key, and the key is going to fix everything and reunite the four realms. And Jonathan Pryce. No, not Jonathan Pryce.
Richard E. Grant.
Richard E. Grant. I always get him confused.
And Eugenio Derbez.
Richard E. Grant is the realm of ice. Eugenio Derbez is the realm of flowers. And he is playing some floofy gay in this. Like, the floofiest of floofy gays.
Well, he's covered in flowers.
He's covered in flowers.
How else is he going to play?
His hair is covered in flowers. And I was like, I respect that look. I'm going to start dressing like that. I'm going to just adorn myself in nothing but flowers.
This, for everything I hate about this movie, which is just about everything,
yeah,
the costumes
are staggering.
Are great.
The costumes are stunning.
Jenny Bavin.
Hand the costume designer an Academy Award right now.
Just gorgeous.
Hand nothing else in this film an Academy Award.
No.
But hand the costume designer an Academy Award right now. So Sugar Plum Fairy leads her to the
we don't have to get into the plot.
It's very important. There's also a Nutcracker who's a soldier, played by a guy whose name I cannot remember. They go to the Helen Mirren's house, and Helen Mirren's like, nope, you can't have the key. I'm bad. They steal the key. They get the key. They give it back to Sugar Plum Fairy. Sugar Plum Fairy goes, ha ha, I'm the evil one.
You're really going to give all this away?
Why not?
All right, fine. Jaden Fawora Knight plays the Nutcracker.
All right.
With a disconcerting, like, metallic lipstick that the light occasionally catches.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
That I couldn't, but it was...
Makeup also cool in this film.
But his makeup was strange because, you know, they
I liked his gold lips.
They give him the gold lips and, like, the sort of red dot rougey things that you get on Nutcracker.
He's like a toy soldier Nutcracker.
Right,
yeah.
But the actor is black.
Yes.
And it's like they just put white person makeup on him because the rouge kind of disappears unless he's at just the right angle. Like, oh yeah, right, he's got the rouge on. Like it was.
See, I wasn't thinking about it like that. I was thinking about how it just made him look wild, and everyone in the movie looks wild. And it is as though the people who are responsible for this film just said, you know, more.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. From the very first shot of this movie, which I thought, oh wait, is this a cartoon that I misunderstand the trailers? Because everything is so completely CG artificial.
Yeah.
It felt like we were back in like the Zemeckis A Christmas Carol.
Yes. Misty Copeland pops up and does a dance explaining the four realms, although it doesn't explain anything.
But she dances really nice.
And she's terrific. And then, as I said, the Sugar Plum Fairy becomes diabolical and... Helen Mirren is the helper, is actually the good person, and then it's fight, 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 war.
Yeah, it's very
the
much...
And you go back to Drosselmeyer's house, Clara's back, she's got the key, the egg opens up, it's a music box, her mother loved her, everyone's sad about the mom being dead, but whatever, it's Christmas, and then Misty Copeland dances some more over the credits. The end. You despised this film.
I did, yes. Because it's a hot mess. I mean, it spends half of it the time explaining itself. Like, here's what the four realms are, and here's this. You know, it goes from being like we're in steampunk London to suddenly here's a machine your mother invented that turns toys into living beings.
Yeah,
like,
her mother was Hedy Lamarr and invented all these things.
You know, that's a lot, and it just, I found it baffling. It's excessive. It is. I didn't find the characters interesting at all. Like Richard Grant and Eugenio Derbez get nothing to do.
Not much, but they have great costumes.
They have great costumes. Absolutely. You know, Keira Knightley, it's fun because before she becomes all evil, she's this sort of like kind of bubbly pixie, which is not her usual thing to do in a movie. And so that was fun to watch. But, you know, it becomes this sort of big special effects-y thing. It reminded me way too much of that, of like the terrible Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
So, like, you get this battle scene at the end. It's like this army of 7-foot-tall automaton tin soldiers attacking robot Helen Mirren, who's 30 feet tall and whose skirts are a circus big top. And I was like, I'm done. I'm out. Right. I don't care.
Yeah.
And I didn't care.
I gotta say that I did not hate it.
Okay.
Because it was so big and dumb. And it looked so cool in spite of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And Misty Copeland dances in the middle of it.
I wanted way more of that.
And I couldn't bring myself to be angry about everything that was wrong.
Okay.
Because there were too many things to be wrong. It's sort of like one mishap will kind of piss you off in a day, but if 9 of them happen, you just start laughing. And that's sort of this movie.
Okay,
where
well,
everything is sort of wrong at the same time, and you're like, whatever! It's the Nutcracker in space or something. And
you are describing how I felt about Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh, well, Bohemian Rhapsody is...
It's a stupid movie.
It's stupid.
But yeah. I was very entertained for enough of it that I
checked my watch more often in Bohemian Rhapsody than I did in Nutcracker.
Because I think Bohemian Rhapsody is like Nutcracker and Mamma Mia 2 were for you. Which is like...
No. Mamma Mia 2 was straight up pleasure.
Okay.
Nutcracker, I'll never watch this again.
Well,
but I couldn't bring myself to despise it.
Bohemian Rhapsody, I cannot defend in any way. Like, you know, it is a rock biopic that pretends that Walk Hard never happened, and so
it pretends that a lot of things happened to Freddie Mercury that never happened either.
I'm getting to that too. Yeah, factually, it's complete bollocks.
Yeah,
but when Rami Malek stops struggling with the overbite prosthetic they've given him, which he can't talk with that thing in his mouth.
He sounds like Katharine Hepburn with a full Slinky toy in her mouth. It's so weird. It's trying to listen to him talk.
It's like, did they not give it to him during the rehearsals?
I don't know.
Because it's like they just shoved it in there.
And too big, his mouth trying to work around it. And respect to him for all the lip syncing.
Well, that's what I was going to say. When he shuts up and just does the lip syncing, the lip syncing is next level. Like, all of the performance sequences are like, wow, okay, this
is
cool.
There are moments in this movie where I think, is Rami Malek actually singing just like Freddie Mercury? I was like, no, he's just doing impeccable lip sync work.
Yeah. You know, so I liked that stuff, and I liked these sort of origin stories of the hits.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, here's how we put together Bohemian Rhapsody. Right. Here's how we put together Another One Bites the Dust. All that stuff. I found that really entertaining.
Yeah.
And by the end of the movie, when they're recreating the Live Aid thing, which is so extraordinary, and I'm finding several people online are talking about this. Like for some reason, I was brought to tears by Radio Gaga, which is one of the worst songs ever written.
I don't know why. But the way
that it's presented in this movie, I just found so exhilarating. And for a minute there, as the credits are rolling, I thought, okay, wow, this movie kind of surprised me. It's actually a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And the more I thought, I was like, no, this movie is still bad, but I still had a good time.
Yeah. No, it stinks.
It's bad, but I enjoyed myself.
And I was bored. The sequences you're describing, the concert footage,
yeah,
and the here's how we made this song sequences. That's entertaining to watch. The other element that was entertaining to me is the stuff that wasn't supposed to be entertaining to me.
The evil gay,
Alan Leach, the chauffeur from Downton Abbey, is a treacherous gay.
Oh, so such an evil queen.
Did this person even exist in real life?
He did exist.
All right.
Was
he very, very bad? Or is there a defamation suit waiting to be happening?
Apparently, one of the few things that is sort of true is that he was close to Freddie Mercury and then like talked to the tabloids about him.
Right.
Like, that's his main thing. But in this movie, they turn him into, like, this Machiavellian figure who takes Freddie away from the band.
Is he alive still?
I don't know. But, like, you know, and then there's this whole nonsense about how, like, Freddie has to reconcile with the band in time for Live Aid and then tell them he has AIDS, even though none of these things actually happened. Or if they did, they happened in totally different chronology.
They happened in totally different ways. Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, like, as far as a factual biopic, it's a complete lie. There are way too many living members of Queen who just wanted to make this as an infomercial for the greatest hits. But as an infomercial for the greatest hits, it makes you want to hear the greatest hits.
Alan Leach pops up with that mustache.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's right. Go wreak some havoc. Don't dream it. Be it. Do all the evil that you can do, Mr. Gay.
You know, there was the initial concern was, you know, that they were going to somehow straight wash Freddie Mercury.
They do not.
They do not. But they also, like, they don't make the gayness much fun.
No, it's not fun for him at all. And clearly, listen, I'll tell y'all a real true fact. It's fun.
Yeah. If you aren't having fun, you're doing it wrong.
I believe that all sexual orientations should be fun.
Yes.
But the way, I mean, obviously he was closeted,
mm-hmm.
and that was the era where you kind of had to be.
Yeah.
But in spite of the fact that he was closeted, he was still having a really good time in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a dour quality to his queer self-expression in this film. And I found that irritating. And I felt like they only did it to make it more dramatic when he finally meets his boyfriend.
Right. Because the whole early part where he's married to a woman is not dour.
No.
Even though he's
they
like,
love and care for each other.
Yeah. Even though he's having these sort of furtive, anonymous, like truckers in restrooms, you know, hookups while they're on tour and everything.
Yeah,
leave it to Bryan Singer to make homosexuality look like a total drag.
Right. So when the guy who is going to be the future boyfriend / unofficial husband shows up, he literally says, "Keep your hands off me. When you love yourself, I'll be ready. Now you just trot along." I mean, like, it's that.
Yeah. Oh,
ridiculous.
Okay, if you're going to give away the ending of the Keira Knightley's Evil in Nutcracker, I'm giving away the end stuff of Bohemian Rhapsody.
All the reviews do give away.
Yeah,
the end
it doesn't
stuff
matter
of
because
movie.
It never happened.
Right.
According to this movie, Freddie Mercury reconnects with the man who would be the love of his life for the rest of his life.
Yes.
And reconciles with his traditionalist father on the way to Wembley for Live Aid.
In the car.
Like,
driver, stop here. I've got to pick up my new boyfriend. Driver, stop here. I need to reconcile with my parents. Driver, stop here. I need to get a lottery ticket. Driver.
We have a couple of plot points to hit on the way. I hope that's
driver,
all right.
Stop here. I need to return some videotapes to Blockbuster. It is 1985. Driver.
Driver, stop. I need a map of the stars home.
Driver, can we please stop at the Tesco for some Marmite? I was hoping there would be more stops. And then at the same time, I was hoping the movie would end because it's like 9 hours long.
It's award season. Everything's way too long.
Rami Malek is great at pretending to be Freddie Mercury on stage.
Yes.
And seemed to be struggling with that mouth.
Yeah.
Off.
I was amazed because all the early buzz about this movie was, oh, Rami Malek, so amazing. Such a, just disappears into the role. A, he does not, which, is it's a tough thing to do. It can be done. Like, I think Michael Douglas disappears into being Liberace, which I think these are two interesting movies to look at side by side.
Oh, frankly, I agree.
Behind the Candelabra, because it's also about like a closeted gay guy who wound up with HIV.
And Liberace becomes his own treacherous gay.
True.
Yeah.
But I heard him talking like, oh my god, is he going to talk like that the whole movie? And it's like the overbite
sure is.
The overbite is correct in terms
of. Oh, my name is Freddie Mercury.
Looking like Freddie Mercury. It's like, yes, Freddie.
I'm announcing Bohemian Rhapsody for you.
Freddie Mercury spent a lifetime talking and singing with those teeth in his mouth and knew how
to
do it.
They were perfectly natural.
And
for
Rami Malek did not know how to do the same. So, oy.
We still have one more to go, Shirkers.
Yes.
But I want to let everybody know that the next episode, we're going to dig in to Boy Erased.
Yes.
A Bread Factory.
Yes.
The Other Side of the Wind.
And They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
These two, the Orson Welles stuff on Netflix.
Yeah.
Burning.
Yes.
Which is this astonishing Korean film that's playing right now. And the new Frederick Wiseman movie, Monrovia, Indiana.
Yes.
As well as
The Grinch.
The Grinch and The Front Runner. And I'm looking at my list here. Overlord.
Yes. And
there's a heck of a lot of movies.
And we hope to have a special guest. I never say who the guest is going to be because that always seems to jinx it.
Isn't the special guest confirmed, though?
Yeah, but
But you never know.
Things can happen.
Things can happen, right. Special guest.
There could be a fire in the barn.
Look,
you know?
We have a planned special guest for the next episode. So
we're very excited about it.
Okay, Shirkers. Oh, my God. I have to say something right off the bat. Sandy Tan, who is the director of Shirkers,
yes,
is a friend of ours. We have known her for years now. She is married to John Powers, who's the film critic for Vogue.
Who has been on the show.
Who has been on the show as well. If I did not know Sandy Tan... See, here's the thing. When we know somebody who is associated with a film, we usually come right up and say, we're not reviewing this. We're just going to talk about it. Oh, no. Not this time. I'm reviewing this.
Yes.
Because if I did not know her, if she was a stranger to me, I would still be head over heels for this movie.
Yeah.
I love it so much and feel so many feelings about it that when I see her next, I feel like I might upset her by hugging her too long. She does not like to be hugged. This is a fact about Sandy Tan that I know.
And you'll kind of pick up on that once you watch Shirkers.
All right, here's a story. She grows up in Singapore.
Yes.
And somewhere along the way in her childhood, she is introduced to, in her words, weird movies and unpopular music. So basically, my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she decides with her group of friends that they're going to make a movie.
Yeah.
And so they do. And they do so with the cooperation and overseeing... Guidance, question mark, for sure. Of a teacher.
Yes.
Who becomes very close to them.
George Cardona.
Yes.
Sandy writes this movie, stars in it.
Directs it.
No. Cardona directs it.
I'm sorry. Cardona directs it. And they mostly finish?
They finish principal photography.
And then?
He and the footage disappear.
He disappears and he takes it all with him. And for years, among her friends. Here's the craziest thing, right? I never knew anything about any of this.
No, me neither.
And
among her and her friends, it's this thing that they just like.
It's this mythology.
Yeah.
That they did this thing, and where did it go?
Yeah.
Did they make it up in their head? Like, did we dream this? He disappears with the footage. And then,
decades later,
his widow says, hey, I have some stuff that you want. And they get it all back without the sound. The action, but not the sound. And so this documentary is about that story.
Yeah.
It is about the reconstruction of sorts,
yeah,
of the film, and it's about her relationships with all of these people and the mystery of this guy,
yes,
who it turns out is like a pathological liar who just tells anybody anything to get what he needs. And it's about
the awakening of a creative spirit. It's about...
And what happens when someone tries to squash it? And then what happens when you let them do that? And then what happens later in life when you look back on the things you've done and you have to wonder what kind of person you were?
Exactly.
And what kind of person you became?
It's like when you just revisiting your own work is a way of revisiting who you were at the time that you made it.
Yes.
And also then... The your friends who worked on it with you, not only them doing it for themselves, but also looking back at what you were like at that point and how you treated people. It's an amazing just exploration of how art gets made and what it does to you.
I had two strong feelings leaving this. One, just pure love for this movie. This is one of my favorite films of the year.
No question.
I don't even care that I know you, Sandy Tan. This is one of my favorite films of the year.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing. Had Shirkers been made and released,
yeah,
I would have read about it in Ben is Dead.
Yes.
I would have read about it in Film Threat. Mm-hmm. I would have read about it. I would have gotten to see it if it had come to the USA Film Festival in Dallas, Texas.
True, yeah.
And it would have. I think about our friend Sarah Jacobson.
Totally.
Who, she is dead. She died young, very young. But she made two feature films. One was called I Was a Teenage Serial Killer, and another one called Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore. And TCM Underground...
I would say both of which are coming on TCM soon.
TCM Underground is about to show them this month, correct?
I believe, yes, in November. I'm trying to look it up.
Yeah. Shirkers would be on TCM Underground this month.
Mm.
With the Sarah Jacobson films.
Yeah.
I would have known about Sandy Tan well before I ever met her, if I ever would have met her.
These are like zine culture movies.
This is the kind of movie that everyone I knew in the early 90s would have said, "Have you seen this?"
Mm.
Because it's before Wes Anderson, before Ghost World, and yet it anticipated those things. I have this whole imaginary life now for what this movie would have been to me and everyone I know in that decade. You know, I would have met you in 1995 and you would have said, "I've got to show you this movie." And I would have said, "Oh, I know, I've already seen it." Like, that is where this would have all gone.
They are definitely both airing in November, but this dang TCM.
All right, we'll find it. We'll put it up on the Patreon and on the Facebook.
Yes, we'll definitely be promoting the Sarah Jacobson films. But Shirkers is on Netflix, so you can watch it right now.
If you have Netflix, you can watch it right now. In fact, it opened theatrically in Los Angeles for at least a week, and it may still be on a screen here in the city somewhere. I know it was at the Music Hall. I don't know where it is right now, if it's anywhere. But if you live in a big enough city, it may actually still be playing in a theater.
Yeah.
And anyway, you can see it is fine.
Absolutely.
Just see it. It's wonderful.
And what's so fascinating is that right now, like Netflix, for people who are super into movies, you know, the exciting thing happening is these Orson Welles movies.
Right.
And, you know, this was a film, again, which was made and then never finished and lost. And, you know, they finally had to, like, get all this footage together. But, you know, they were able to reconstruct the sound and actually complete the film. But, you know, it's interesting to look at Shirkers in the light also of those two movies. But, yeah, it's an exciting movie about filmmaking, but also just the personal angle of it as well, I think, is really, it means a lot.
Yeah. Okay, we're done.
Yeah.
For now.
This is, we'll be back.
Should we do it like an extra episode to pick up the slack on some other films? Like, I feel somehow like maybe we should. I don't know if we will, but that's how I'm feeling right
maybe,
now.
Maybe, because there's just so much going on
right now is that I have to go to bed.
I understand. Maybe we'll do that so that we don't have to burden our guests with 10,000 things.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we'll figure that out. Yeah. And we'll have DVD picks later. We'll have letters later. I'll even skip my usual recommendations of all the places to go look on the internet. You can listen to other episodes where I recommend podcasts.
Yes.
So thank you for listening.
I got to go vote.
Yes, 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 yes.
Again, I got to go vote against all the Republicans.
You know, leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts.
Is this your first time listening? Does that upset you? Too bad.
Leave us a positive review in all the places that we stream, like Spotify, etc. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back very soon because there's so much going on. It's really hard to keep up. But thank you for listening. Come back.
Goodbye.